This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our virtual Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. Today we're going to start our show with a discussion of a new book by an author that you may have heard of, David Troyer. He's an anthropologist, but he teaches literature and creative writing at the University of Southern California. And he joins us by phone to talk about his new book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, the story of Native America from 1890 to the present. And it also touches on pre-Columbian Native life as well. David, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's the next best thing to being home. I miss it. I miss the North.
Okay. Well, why did you write the book?
Well, it's a big book that was many years in the making, but I wrote it out of a frustration, a feeling of frustration that I've had for a really long time, and I think maybe a lot of other Native people have had, which is that we are often live lives that are unremarked upon, that most people think that Native life, so defined, died around the year 1890, and that if there are any Native people left, all we're doing is living lives of perpetual suffering, which isn't really any kind of life at all. And you feel this in your interactions with people when you explain to them where you're from and who you are, and they either are surprised, like the woman my brother was talking to in college, who told him he couldn't be Indian because he was alive, and that actually happened. Or they make the assumption that our lives are necessarily awful. And this is this kind of attitude, we find it in people we talk to on the street, we find it in our social interactions, and we find it in the literature. Dee Brown's classic, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, and that was the real impetus for my book, published in 1970, says on the very first page that he's focusing on the Plains Wars, and he starts in 1850, and he ends at 1890, where, quote, the culture and civilization of the American Indian was destroyed, end quote. And I wanted to write a book that filled that void, the void of the last 125 years, where we've been doing more than simply surviving, that should be understood as more than simply a history, which is a laundry list of abuse. I wanted to point to the fact that we've been making our own history, we've been living our lives, we've been doing interesting things, and our lives are complex and varied and textured, and I wanted to explore that.
Well, your life is, of course, interesting in its own right. You were born and raised on the Leech Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota, and your mother is Ojibwe as well. Your father was a survivor of the Holocaust. So you've got this interesting background. Let's just explore a piece of that. Why did you choose to study so deeply anthropology?
Well, I've never taught anthropology. I've never written anthropology, but I was a student of it as an undergrad and as a grad student. And for me, I felt that at that time, anthropology was a great place to have an argument, and I love having arguments. And anthropology was tackling really, really important things. It was looking at how we understand other people. How do we see other people without mapping our own biases on top of them? What role does storytelling play in the formation of our shared realities? And that last part is really important to my book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee. I was really interested in writing not just a counter history with different names and different dates and different events than we're used to hearing. I wanted to write a counter narrative. That is, I wanted to leave behind and largely destroy the tragic narrative, which is used almost exclusively to tell stories of Native lives, and replace it with its opposite, which is not, I should say, a story of hope. Hope is just the other side of the tragic coin. It's the same currency. What I was interested in doing was telling the opposite of tragedy, was using a different narrative, and to me that's a narrative of complexity, depth, layering, and diversity. Those things together are the opposite of tragedy.
Structured throughout your book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, are lines like, through it all, Indians remain. Why does this idea bear repeating?
Well, because people think we don't. And we often think we don't. And that's part of it, too. This book isn't just for outsiders. It's not just for non-Indians. It's for us. I think too often we assume the worst of ourselves, and our understanding of our own history is often overly inflected by the dominant narrative, which is that we were once great and we are great no more, and that our history is only a litany of abuse that we've managed somehow to survive. I think we share that perception, and I wanted to destroy it in us, too, and replace it with something else.
Well, about the time that Dee Brown's book came out, of course, there was a counterculture movement in our country. I was a young man at that time, so I'm well aware of that. And about that same time, the American Indian movement started. How would you characterize that movement and what resulted from it?
Well, the American Indian movement is pretty complicated. You had the actions of some of its leadership, like Russell Means and Dennis Banks, which left a lot to be desired, in my opinion. And I'm only speaking for myself, by the way. And you had the actions of the rank and file, of the people who staffed the schools that AIM started in places like Minneapolis and hired the teachers and taught the kids, people who went on the AIM patrols, policing the police in neighborhoods like South Minneapolis. You had the people who started and worked to secure funding for and staffed places like American Indian OIC and other things like that, that provided job training and benefits for people in cities like Minneapolis. So AIM was a mixed movement, to be sure. And one thing that AIM did do in relation to its street theater and its takeovers and so on, which was really positive, was it drew the nation's attention to our continued existence and to the continued deficit the government runs in terms of how well it attends to its treaty obligations in relation to sovereign Indian nations.
At the time of that book, and again still today, most American Indians live in urban areas, don't they? What were the consequences of moving away from their tribal culture? You referred to Minneapolis. Little Earth is there. I mean, there's a sort of a cultural center for Native Americans in Minneapolis. But how has this changed?
Well, two things. One, most Indians don't live in cities. But when people say that over half of the Native population lives off of reservations, that can include on land just outside the border. It can include towns like Bemidji and Grand Rapids and Deer River, Walker, as well as large cities. So there has been a diaspora from reservations outward to all different parts of the American land and cityscape. So that's one thing. And two, let's talk about the sentiment contained in the second part of your question, which is, what does it mean for Indians to leave their culture behind? Who's to say that that happened? Who's to say that Native folk didn't bring their cultures with them to places like Minneapolis and Chicago and Los Angeles and Denver and Seattle and New York?
Point taken. The Dakota Access Pipeline protest around the Standing Rock Reservation a couple of years ago brought many tribal activists together. Matter of fact, I was in Singapore, ran into one of them there. Is that evidence of Native coalitions finding strength through unity now? Or is there a movement out there?
I mean, there are many movements out there. That's one thing that I hope my book communicates, that there's no such thing as Indian life. There are only Indian lives. Tribal cultures were diverse before Europeans set foot in North America. We remained diverse during the long period of colonization, and we remain today diverse as we go about the business of being Native and modern and American and whatever else, all simultaneously. And if history has shown us anything, it's that when tribes have not worked well together, that we were at our weakest. And what Standing Rock, the protest at Standing Rock shows us, is that when we are able to build broad coalitions, not just amongst ourselves, but with broader and wider America, then we can really flex the power that we've always had. And I think it's important to note that in places like North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota, for example, it's increasingly harder to get elected unless you have a relationship with Indian communities. If that weren't true, then there wouldn't be voter suppression laws on the books in places like North Dakota.
There are a record number of indigenous people, especially women, who have run for office and have been elected now in this last cycle in particular. What change do you think they might bring to the job?
Well, someone just asked me about Charisse Davids and whether I thought she was a beacon of hope for Native people. I said, well, sure, of course she is. But I think more importantly, she's a beacon of hope for all Kansans. And I don't think North Dakota is different in this regard, or South Dakota, and Minnesota as well. But her understanding of her historical experience as a Native American person and of the ways in which she has been, or her people have been, that our people have been disenfranchised or disregarded and certainly ill-served by the government, is going to put her in a fantastic place to lead all Kansans, because let's face it, those of us who are from the parts of America that coastal folks think of as flyover states increasingly have a difficult time getting access to education, to capital, to adequate health care, and to employment. So most of Middle America is finding itself in the position that Native people have been in for centuries. So who better to lead all of us to some better future than someone who understands exactly what that's like? So I'm pretty happy for the state of Kansas.
How do you wish indigenous history were taught in our schools?
Well, that's a big question, but one thing is that people could maybe let go of using the past tense almost exclusively and think about using the present tense, even in terms of how they talk. Not what Indian lives were like, but what Native lives are like. And that would be a big change. And one big change, you know, in terms of how our history and how our realities are taught in schools is something that is worth consideration by all of us, which is that we have been making history not always with tools of our choosing, but making it nonetheless. And that to understand America, to understand American history, you need to understand American Indian history. The colonists' very first act in defiance of the British government was to throw tea in Boston Harbor, and they didn't just throw tea, they dressed up like Mohawk Indians and then dumped tea in Boston Harbor.
Yes.
Since then, and throughout, America has understood herself in relation to Native people, has practiced the American experiment in relation to us. You can see America's best behaviors and its worst behaviors in how it's dealt and lived with us. So to understand America, you need to understand us. I think that would be important to note.
We hear terms like, and I've been using terms like Native American, Indian, indigenous people. Is there consensus on the terminology?
Nope.
Yeah.
There's no consensus. So the rule of thumb is to always ask. I use the phrases American Indian, Native American, Native, Indigenous, Indian, First Nations interchangeably.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just me. I don't speak for anybody else. And I don't really care as long as people don't use an epithet. However, a lot of other people care deeply, and as they should. So when talking to someone or about someone, ask the person you're talking to. That's the best rule of thumb.
Well, you were raised in the Ojibwe culture. How would you characterize that to someone who wasn't? How would you describe being Ojibwe to somebody who isn't?
How would you describe being white to somebody who isn't? It's impossible to describe. It's impossible to describe it in any kind of concise way. What it's like to be Ojibwe is as vast as what it's like to be white or Asian or African American or Latino. It's both as vast and as particular because it's just an individual experience. So it's impossible to say, and I don't think I want to try and cram it all into a soundbite, if you don't mind.
In your book, you write that by 1944, when the World War II was trailing off, getting near the end, more than a third of the Native adult male population had served. Why do you think so many did?
Oh, there's so many reasons. I mean, on one hand, for American Indian men in the 1930s and 40s, the best many of them could hope for was day labor, if they could find any kind of work. And so joining the military guaranteed you a paycheck and 3 square meals a day, and that's certainly part of people's decisions to join. But also, American Indian people then and now, many of them thought of themselves as both Native and American and saw no contradiction between those two things. And by defending America, they were also defending their tribal homelands, and so they're patriots. My grandfather was no exception. He volunteered to serve in the Second World War, and he fought at Normandy in the Battle of the Bulge, and he fought as a Native man, and he fought as an American, and he was proud. And different tribes value that kind of service differently, perhaps, than mainstream America. At least in my context, for Ojibwe people, there are certain ceremonial jobs that are only open to veterans. So that's another reason why at least some Ojibwe people would join up and want to fight.
Movies and other historical representations often portrayed Indians as not understanding or believing in property ownership. Where did that idea come from?
Oh, that idea came from people who wanted to steal our property.
Okay. It's easier to take it from somebody who doesn't own it?
Right. It's the best way. Like, well, it's not really stealing if the person I'm taking it from doesn't even understand that they own it or doesn't even understand what ownership is. No, that's just part of a land grab. That's certainly not true culturally. It's not true socially. It's not true intellectually. It's basically a lie that people told so that they could steal our land and not feel quite so bad about it. That's the only place that's from.
Well, let's take another kind of a cultural process here. Native casinos, you know, they have gambling. Some of them offer liquor. That seems antithetical to the culture, at least as it's presented to my culture, from the perspective of non-Indians, that is what I'm saying. What's your take on that?
Well, we've always had gambling. I mean, at least my tribe has, and many other tribes. Gambling is something we've always done. It's a right we've always had, and it's a right we never surrendered. And so once we could make the United States Supreme Court and then thus the American government understand that tribal gaming was a right that we had reserved and never given up, and we were just going to continue to practice it in a modern context, then we started to operate casinos. What effect does that have on tribal cultures? Well, what effect does the Apple Corporation have on white culture? What effect does Google have on French culture? Well, probably some positive effects and probably some negative effects. It's complicated. Casinos are no different. It's impossible to summarize their total effect on all these diverse cultures across the country because the effect is a complicated effect. Are they bad in some ways? Sure. Are they good in some ways? Absolutely.
Well, they're looked at in some ways, the good part, as providing employment, providing economic development, helping to transform some reservations from places where there's a fair amount of poverty and crime to better places to live.
You know, it's a really ironic. And you'll notice this if you just pay attention to the news. What's really ironic is that outsiders start talking about the deleterious effects that casinos are having on Indian people only in relation to the casinos that are earning a lot of money. And that is because the idea of rich Indians bothers people. And I should note that of the 320-plus federally recognized tribes in the United States, only about a third have gambling operations around 100 or so. Of that 100 or so, a tiny fraction earn a lot of money. The rest, not so much. But that tiny fraction disturbs everybody because I think we're supposed to be poor. It's our social function to exist at the outermost limit of the republic. So I like it when people are uncomfortable, though. It's kind of fun.
Let's get into Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, who's run into some severe criticism for her statements about her native ancestors. What does being Indian mean?
To me? Or to her? Or to Trump?
Pick one.
Another one of these impossible questions. But you know what I was thinking about this morning? Trump has made being feckless and dishonest part of his brand. And he gets away with it. From those Access Hollywood tapes that aired, 2 weeks before the election, to the inanities and lies he utters every day on air and on Twitter, it's a part of his brand. Senator Warren has gone time and time and again back to the well of ethics and tried to quell criticism and has taken tests and has made apologies. And every time she does it, she fails. And I find it deeply ironic that someone who's trying to be ethical is made out to be the bandit when the person who's made it part of his brand to be unethical gets away with it all the time. And you want to know why? Because people are baiting a hook and we're biting at that bait at every chance we get. That Senator Warren grew up thinking that she was Native because she heard stories is not surprising because half the people from Oklahoma grew up hearing those stories and thinking that. And so she put it on her bar exam piece of paper. Okay. And then she took a DNA test which proves, hey, guess what? she wasn't lying, that it was true. And all of this is inconsequential, in my opinion, when you start thinking about what's really interesting about Warren, which are her economic policies. She is determined to try and close the wealth gap that is ripping our country apart. But people don't want her to close it, and so they hang her out to dry on this identity politics nonsense. That's not a story. It's not an interesting story. Her economic policies are the interesting story, and we should talk about those instead.
Well, David Troyer, you are a provocative talker and writer, and this book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, Native America, 1890 to the Present, is a very interesting book, and thank you for spending some time with us today.
Thank you, and stay warm. I hear it's cold up there.
It is. Up next on Main Street, Mark Trahant on an interesting story that further illuminates Native American history.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by AARP North Dakota, protecting families from fraud and scams, and helping more than 62,000 family caregivers who help make it possible for their loved ones to live at home, creating real possibilities in North Dakota. AARP.org/ND.
Hey, this is Bill Thomas at Prairie Public, and thanks and congratulations, too, to everybody who joined up or renewed the short and sweet membership drive. Delicious cocoa truffles going out all over the place, and it's wonderful. If you haven't joined already, well, you can. You can call 800-359-4145 or go to prairiepublic.org up till February 8th. That's the deadline. So if you still want to get in on it, you can. Let's hear from you, and thanks to everybody who helped.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. David Troyer's new book focuses on the history of the American Indian after the infamous 1890 massacre that took place on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. Mark Trahant, a member of Idaho's Shoshone-Bannock tribe, is the editor of Indian Country Today. Here's Trahant's essay on the less well-known history of America's indigenous people before European settlement.
A new study documents the cost of colonialism. This is Trahant Reports. Why does it matter? Because the invasion of the Americas changed everything on the planet. There was a death rate of more than 90% of the people, now labeled depopulation in a scientific report. At the time, the indigenous population of the Americas was 10% of the world's population and home to the largest and most complex cities. The study also raises new questions: the impact of humans on nature and what that might mean for climate change policy in the decades ahead. The paper, Earth Systems: Impacts of the European Arrival and the Great Dying in the Americas After 1492, was written by four geographers from University College London. The globe went through climate change, a tiny shift of temperatures of 15/100ths of a degree, but that was enough to lead to colder temperatures worldwide that resulted in crop failures and colder summers. The paper explores a big question. Did the invasion and depopulation of the Americas in the 16th and 17th century result in those declines in temperatures, the Little Ice Age? And was that a result of natural forces or because the large-scale depopulation of the Americas after European arrival, subsequent land use change, and secondary secession? The evidence is complicated. The indigenous Americas went through a rapid and dramatic shift, a before-contact and after-contact story. Looking at all of the evidence available today, the University College London team came to the conclusion that the indigenous population had reached more than 60 million people before contact. That would have been about 10% of the world's population. And the cities in the Americas would have been among the most populous on the planet. In less than 100 years, that indigenous America population was reduced to 5 or 6 million people. A population decline that exceeded 90%, the Great Dying. The scientists calculated how such a rapid population decline changed agriculture. Think of what it took to feed 60 million people, and then what would happen when that farmland became forest and jungle. The scale of that regrowth was huge, roughly a landmass twice the size of Colorado. And the scale is significant, because indigenous land use was so widespread before European arrival, particularly in Mexico, Central America, Bolivia, and the Andes, where terraced fields and irrigated agriculture were common. Indeed, it's the scale of this report, of this history, that's daunting. But like any important study, this one by University College London opens up far more questions than answers. I'm Mark Trahant.
You can read more of Mark Trahant's work and follow Native News at IndianCountryToday.com. Coming up on Main Street, another installment from the Harvest Public Media series on the trade war between the U.S. and China. Sue Balcom joins us for some Main Street Eats tips for Valentine's Day. And we'll look at our What's Happening calendar of things to do. First, the news.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. Most of eastern North Dakota is seeing blizzard conditions with some light snow and high winds, and that's reducing visibility and causing drifting. The North Dakota Department of Transportation and Highway Patrol are advising no travel, and that message is being echoed by the National Weather Service.
They're shutting down the roads all over the place, so they, you know, the DOTs are pretty strongly messaging as well that it's best to stay home if at all possible.
National Weather Service meteorologist Nick Carletta in Grand Forks.
We've been continuing to see a little bit of additional snow. I believe earlier we were saying like 1 to 3 inches in the Red River Valley of additional snow, and that's still roughly on track. Seeing an additional couple inches fall within the valley as our currently falling snow continues to fall. That should continue here into the afternoon, and then after that, the winds should continue to blow the snow into the evening hours before starting to improve in the overnight.
A bill to allow counties to publish bills they pay on county websites instead of the newspaper has failed in the House because it did not get a constitutional majority to pass. The bill needed 48 votes to pass but received 47. Finley Republican Representative Bill Devlin told the House many people don't pay attention to the county websites, and it seems to be another attempt to reduce openness in government.
I'm always shocked by this type of bill. When I watch the ads that campaigns run over the years, everybody runs on openness and transparency in government. And then why in the world would we try to hide the amount of money being spent for county expenses from local taxpayers that provide the funds?
But the sponsor, Castleton Representative Brandy Pyle, told the House this is actually an effort to provide more information to voters.
I can testify that the Cass County Auditor has a fabulous website that actually offers more information as to what fund the expenses are extracted from and where they're going to, and much more information that can be provided for than in a newspaper in the column width of the paper.
Five House members were absent for the vote. The bill could be brought back to the House tomorrow. And rural hospitals are struggling around the country for several reasons. Harvest Public Media's Madeline Beck has more on a recent national effort to identify the biggest issues so that policymakers can do something about it.
The American Hospital Association recently released a report that outlines rural hospital challenges, ranging from not enough employees to rising drug prices to issues with federal health care laws. There were nearly 100 rural hospital closures in the last 8 years, and the association says just one can devastate a rural area. David Schreiner is the president and CEO at Catherine Shaw Bethea Hospital in Dixon, Illinois. He says the report's findings aren't new to him, but something lawmakers and other leaders need to understand.
We need to have all voting members understand what the stakes are here. And if rural hospitals are not successful, it has a significant downstream impact on the rest of the healthcare system.
To check out the report yourself, go to aha.org. Madeline Beck, Harvest Public Media.
For Prairie Public, I'm Todd McDonald.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. If the U.S. and China fail to reach an agreement on trade this month, tariffs will soon reach deeper into the economy. While farmers and manufacturers have been in the middle of the conflict for months, the latest round of talks puts more at stake for consumers. Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach has the story.
In September, the Trump administration launched its biggest round of tariffs yet, a 10% tax on thousands of Chinese products, including a lot of everyday stuff. It made me think of my toolbox. You'll see screwdrivers on the list, hammers, nails, nuts and bolts, and there's stuff like towels, soap, cosmetics. It's all on the list of tariffs. But that doesn't mean the price on the tag is 10% higher. It turns out that a lot of suppliers and retailers have been absorbing the cost themselves.
I can't stress to you how much companies care about maintaining that stability.
This is Uche Jarrett, a professor of international economics at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
It drives their profit margins, it drives their estimates for the future. Whenever there is a change, there's a lot of uncertainty that follows.
An analysis by the New York Federal Reserve estimates consumer prices overall are about 0.3% higher than they would be without the tariffs. Jared says companies are eating the cost because they'd rather lose profits than lose customers. Good news for shoppers, but it also means the tariffs are less effective because imported Chinese goods are still cheaper than American products.
I mean, the idea is the higher the tariffs, of course, the more you make consumers flip over. But if those prices aren't changing, then you're not going to get the desired effect that you want.
This is where the current negotiations between the U.S. and China could be a turning point. President Donald Trump wants to narrow the trade deficit and protect American technology. But if there's no deal by March 1st, that 10% tariff on Chinese imports will more than double to 25%.
At 10%, you can come to a very minimal change. At 25%, it becomes a different deal.
That's Irv Blumkin. He's the CEO of a home furnishings chain called Nebraska Furniture Mart. Blumkin says a 25% tariff is too big for suppliers to just hide it in their profit margins. It would impact prices for lots of things his company sells.
Certainly outdoor furniture would be, leather furniture. I mean, China is a powerhouse when it comes to producing goods for our industry.
In some cases, the difference could make American products more competitive. But Blumkin is also concerned that higher tariffs following the government shutdown and recent stock market volatility will make shoppers more likely to hold on to their money.
You know, they hear the news every day and they see some of the uncertainties that are going on, and I think that impacts how people think.
One option he says manufacturers have to avoid price hikes is to move production to places like Vietnam, Malaysia, or Mexico. And it's not just importers trying to work around these tariffs. American manufacturers are feeling the effects too. Bison is a company in Lincoln, Nebraska that makes sports hardware. I met the company's CEO, Nick Cusick, at a local YMCA where some office workers were playing a round of pickup basketball. The rims, the backboards, the wall pads, they were all made by Bison, and almost all the parts and pieces came from the U.S.
Since we do compete against a fair number of companies who buy offshore, you would think, generally speaking, that we would benefit from...
Yeah, aren't you supposed to be the winners in this?
We're supposed to be the winners.
Here's the problem for Bison. When the U.S. began taxing imported steel, the price for American steel went up too, as much as 50%. Cusick says the company had to raise prices this year to cover the cost.
We passed as much as we thought we were comfortable with without losing market share. But the end users, the schools, the consumers on our residential basketball side of our business, they're the ones that are getting hit. So it's kind of counterproductive.
Depending how the talks go with China, it could be that more businesses have to bring customers off the sidelines of the trade war and into the game. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
That was the second in Harvest Public Media's three-part series exploring the nearly year-long trade war between the U.S. and China. To read more about tariffs, go to harvestpublicmedia.org. Next on Main Street, Sue Balcom shares some ideas for Valentine's Day.
On this week's North Dakota Legislative Review, Senate Appropriations Committee Chairman Ray Holmberg of Grand Forks will be our guest. We'll talk mainly about budgets, how things are looking, and the importance of the March revenue forecast on spending decisions. That's Legislative Review, Friday at 6:30 p.m. here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg in Fargo, and in Bismarck at our microphone there we have root cellar Sue Balcom because it's time for Main Street Eats.
Sue, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, we are 1 week out from the big chocolate day, Valentine's Day, so let us talk about all things chocolate and delicious and wonderful.
Do you like chocolate?
Just a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, with my oxygen.
Do you like the dark
chocolate.
Yes, I do.
That's my favorite. And with chili in it, you know, like.
That sounds interesting.
Yes. I went to a shop when we were skiing in Bozeman and bought 6 chocolates and took them back to the room, the lodge where we were staying. And I showed my husband and I said, I just bought these 6 beautiful chocolate truffles, and each one had different flavorings in it. And I said they were $16. And he's like, let me get a picture of that. Because he couldn't understand why it costs so much. But good chocolate is worth its weight in gold, don't you think?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. And that's where the history of chocolate I find pretty fascinating, which I would prefer. I like roses, but roses are not a seasonal flower this time of year, and that's why they're so expensive on Valentine's Day. So I would prefer daisies and chocolate over roses and chocolate any day. And spend the money on the chocolate.
Right.
Because it's the fruit of the cacao tree, which is really a, you know, Central America or South America. And the fruits, which are called pods, contain about 40 beans. And it's the beans that are dried and roasted, and that's what makes cocoa. And it started way, way back in the Mayan culture. They used to kind of, they consumed chocolate mostly as a drink. But it was for special occasions. I mean, they really valued chocolate.
It was sacred.
And right. And they passed that on to the Aztecs then. And those guys, they thought cocoa or cocoa beans were so important that they were more valuable than gold back then.
Wow.
Which is probably why they find gold in the ground when they're excavating, but not chocolate. They ate all that. So.
Well, when I was a kid, the only chocolate around was what was called milk chocolate. And, you know, it was I liked it. It was good. But now we've got so many different kinds.
We do. And it's been kind of a natural progression through all of this. You know, like we didn't have chocolate in the American colonies till probably the 1600s. And then, of course, there's a difference between the cacao beans that they use to make really good chocolate, and cocoa is kind of a process. And so cocoa powder was discovered in Europe by the Dutch, which is why it's called Dutch processed. Mm. And you can buy, like if you go to King Arthur Flour and you buy your cocoa, you can get all different kinds of cocoa, like Dutch processed. But I buy this really, really intense dark cocoa, and you only use about a teaspoon or so in a cake batter or a cookie mix, and that's what gives your cakes a really dark, dark, fudgy chocolate look. Too much of it is almost hard to take because it is kind of bitter. But they treated these beans with alkaline salts to make a powdered chocolate that was easier to mix in water. And, of course, drinking chocolate, of course, has always been the way to – I don't think they baked too many chocolate cakes back in the day of the Aztecs. But this Dutch process opened up the doors to our current day chocolate, which, of course, we have Mr. Hershey that started making chocolates in Pennsylvania. But Nestle chocolate bars came about when they decided to add milk to chocolate or cocoa powder, and it made a richer drink. And then he developed a paste made from milk and chocolate, which gives you that milk chocolate that you like so much, the creamy kisses and the chocolate bars with almonds in them.
What do you look for, Sue, when you're trying to find a good chocolate? And let's not do a baking chocolate. Let's do an eating chocolate, like a good bar.
Can I pronounce this? Girardelli? Mm.
Oh, the ones, Girardelli in San Francisco.
Yes, they make really, really good chocolate. But sometimes when you go to like food co-ops, you can find sustainably sourced chocolates with European labels on them. I think they got it over on us. We like the milk chocolate here in this country, but the Europeans, I think, really go for
the
more. I like the bittersweet chocolate much, much better. Dark chocolate, of course, is good for you, you know, and that's one of the reasons why we have started seeking that out here. Hershey's, yep, that's good. And I remember those bars being only a nickel when we were a kid, and they were just like we had to share the squares. Do you ever have to share the squares with somebody?
Yes.
But, yeah, I would totally recommend going. And I think there are more chocolate shops now in North Dakota than there probably were back when we were kids, but I'd go search out somebody who actually made good truffles. And did I hear you talking about truffles earlier today?
Oh, yeah.
That's a come on for our short and sweet fundraiser we do every year, you know, in the dead of winter typically.
Right. And it's not too late. Orders due February 8th.
Oh, good. You know, do you mail those out to people?
Yeah. I mean, if you order today, pretty much.
Doggone it. Yep, I'll have to look for that chocolate online or something.
Those are delicious, but I have a particularly memorable chocolate experience that I'd like to share because I'm still looking to do it again, and that was sipping chocolate. And this it was a small amount. It was viscous. It was not hot chocolate. It was not that. It was something different, and it was extraordinary.
You need to go to the south of Spain.
Yeah, maybe, because I really thought that was extraordinary.
Chocolate?
Well, it wasn't molten. It wasn't real hot. It was like I said, thick and very chocolatey.
Oh, no, me.
Yeah.
My stomach's growling. I'm sorry. I know that's not really one of the basic four food groups, but, you know, maybe we could change that in the food pyramid. Just insist that chocolate is good. I do, and I should look this up. I do have a recipe that I got from Cook's Illustrated magazine for the best powdered chocolate mix on the planet. And so you can buy ingredients, powdered milk and good cocoa and whatever sweetener you want in there, and mix up your own chocolate that you can add to milk. And this stuff is divine. It's not like the little packets that you can find at the gas station. So whatever you do, if you're out there looking for chocolate, look for the stuff with the gold wrapper on, like Willy Wonka would give you.
Well, there's also a bit of a health benefit, interestingly enough, to dark chocolate.
It's an antioxidant. And as you know, our cells are constantly getting battered from the time we're born by the elements around us. And so antioxidants actually help repair those little cells at the very, 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 very deep cellular structure of your being. So I would suggest eating lots of chocolate. That would be my advice for today.
Well, I'm going to take that advice.
And when it's cold, you can have it hot. Or, like, I like mixing hot chocolate packets in my coffee. That way you get a double whammy of caffeine. Because, as you know, chocolate does have caffeine in it. So if you're sensitive to caffeine and you eat a really high-quality chocolate, you can feel that caffeine buzz just like you do with regular coffee. So.
Oh, bon appetit. We check in with Ritzeller Sue Balcom once a week to talk about, well, our Main Street Eats segment. And you have an online presence, don't you, Sue?
Oh, that's right. So when you're looking for these recipes, all you need to do is go to therootsellers, SELLERS.com, and I'll be there for you.
Thank you, Sue.
What's happening is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Radisson Hotel in downtown Fargo, featuring a Valentine's package February 14th through the 16th that includes a guest room, four-course dinner for two, and wine or a sparkling cider delivered to your room. 701-232-7363 or RadissonFargo.com.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, on a blizzardy day for much of our coverage area, it's time to look at what we can do when the weather lifts. And here's one if you want to go to a neat play on Friday and Saturday. This is by a great playwright, A Moon for the Misbegotten. It's one of the works of Eugene O'Neill. And Capital Shakespeare is going to present it in Bismarck at the Russell Reed Auditorium at the North Dakota Heritage Center. A Moon for the Misbegotten, directed by Daniel Rogers, follows Jamie Tyrone through his childhood haunts in search of consolation and forgiveness. Capital Shakespeare is a nonprofit organization committed to producing free Shakespeare plays at the Capitol. And it will take place at 7 o'clock Friday and Saturday, and the price is right. It's free. Red River Market is Saturday in Moorhead, and it's indoors at the E.M. Combs Center. This indoor event will feature pantry items, household goods, baked goods, art, hot food, and beverages. The Red River Winter Market indoor at the E.M. Combs Center from 10 until 2 on Saturday. There's free admittance. You may want to buy something. Also on Saturday, a classic event here in Fargo, the 61st annual Kiwanis Pancake Carnival. It's at the Fargo Dome. This annual tradition has become one of the largest and most recognizable social and charitable events in the region, serving more than 10,000 people and over 30,000 pancakes each year. It was featured in the Guinness Book of World Records. It runs from 7 in the morning until 3 in the afternoon on Saturday at the Fargo Dome. The cost for your pancakes, $8. Wild Spirits Winterfest is Saturday in Minot at the Roosevelt Park Zoo. Minot's favorite festival of frozen fun heats up with intoxicating ice and sultry song. This event will feature an adult night of lights, music, and flights of vodka. Enchantment will spill onto the zoo grounds with firelit pathways and ice sculpture art. Let your wild spirit roam at the Roosevelt Park Zoo. It's from 6 until 9 on Saturday in Minot. The cost is $50. Frozen Feet 5K and 10K is Saturday in Grand Forks. Central High School is where you gather. It's frosty. It's fun. It's the one thing that has been missing from your February calendar. Add this to your winter race schedule, and we'll see you at the Feet. Amenities, a cold weather running swag, a custom medal, a post-race food and beverage, and awards for the top finishers and age category winners. New this year is an optional race shirt for purchase. It runs from 8 in the morning until noon. This is the Frozen Feet 5K and 10K at Central High School in Grand Forks. The cost is $40. The Cozy Winter Night is Saturday in Mandan. The venue is the Loyal Order of the Moose. You can paint along with artist Jessica at the Mandan Moose Lodge. Get ready for lots of laughs and painting fun. Bring a friend or make new ones and leave with your very own 16-by-20-inch canvas. No experience is necessary. You'll be taught step by step. All supplies will be provided. Aprons will be provided, but accidents happen, so wear something you wouldn't mind getting some paint on. It's 1 o'clock in Mandan at the Loyal Order of the Moose. The cost is $25. The Drumming Circle is Saturday in Thief River Falls at New Earth Spiritual Healing Center. They'll be hosting a drumming circle at the store. They have several drums, rhythm instruments, and singing bowls to use. But if you have a drum, feel free to bring it for your use. It will run from 5 until 7 again at the New Earth Spiritual Healing Center in Thief River Falls on Saturday, and it's free. And here's one you might want to check out. Poles and Holes, Sunday in Detroit Lakes. It's right at the lake there at the municipal beach. Join the annual ice fishing event. This year, a community group built an ice palace a few hundred feet from the Derby with ice harvested from Detroit Lake. The palace is 30 feet by 60 feet, over 24 feet tall. It's a real spectacle for the area. Come and try some fishing. Every fish caught has a chance to win a prize, and you'll get to see that ice palace, which has been, of course, a feature of Detroit Lakes. It starts at 9 in the morning. The cost is $40. And let's not forget our short and sweet membership drive, which wraps up tomorrow. Still time to get some of those wonderful truffles from Nicole's Fine Pastry. A $10 sustaining membership gives you a box of those truffles sent anywhere in the continental U.S. in time for Valentine's Day. Give a call at 800-359-4145 or go online to prairiepublic.org and click on Donate, or text support to 484848 and follow the link we send. For those of you who have, thank you. And that's what's happening.
Who's not a fan of Gilbert and Sullivan operettas? NDSU's Chaley School of Music is excited to present Gilbert and Sullivan's Patience, a witty parody of society, and one of their most charming love stories. 7:30 Friday, February 15th, and 2 o'clock Sunday, February 17th, at Festival Concert Hall. All the high society ladies in the village are in love with two poets, but the poets are in love with Patience, the simple village milkmaid, who has no interest in poetry. Tickets are available at 701-231-7969 or ndsu.edu/music.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 7, Remembering Theodore Roosevelt, featuring the words of Roosevelt as read by Steve Stark. President Abraham Lincoln was a friend with Theodore Roosevelt's parents. As a youngster at his grandfather's house, young 6-year-old T.D., as he was called, witnessed Lincoln's coffin procession along New York City's Broadway. Lincoln was T.R.'s presidential hero. Fittingly, these two venerated chief executives earned their destiny to be memorialized in stone, side by side, on Mount Rushmore. Lincoln's February birth month is a fitting occasion for the reflection and admiration T.R. had for the first president felled by an assassin.
Greatly though we now regard Abraham Lincoln, the future will put him on even higher pinnacle than we have put him. In all history, I do not believe that there is to be found an orator whose speeches will last as enduringly as certain speeches of Lincoln. And in all history, with the sole exception of the man who founded the Republic, I do not think there will be found any statesman at once so great and so single-hearted in his devotion to the weal of his people. We cannot too highly honor him, and the highest way in which we can honor him is to see that our homage is not only an homage of words, that to lip loyalty we join the loyalty of the heart. He grew to know greatness, but never ease. Success came to him, but never happiness, save that which springs from doing well a painful but vital task. His tender and great heart shrank from giving pain, and the task allotted to him was to pour out like water the life-blood of the young men, and to feel in his every fiber the sorrow of the women. Disaster saddened, but never dismayed him. Power was his, but no pleasure. The furrows deepened on his brow, but his eyes were undimmed by either hate or fear. His gaunt shoulders were bowed, but his steel thews never faltered as he bore for a burden the destinies of his people. His devotion to the cause was so great that he neither could nor would have any feeling against any individual.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the Historical Society of North Dakota. This series with funding from the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation.
Just a minute left in our show, and just a reminder that we still have some time left in the Short and Sweet membership drive. If you'd like to become a member or up your membership, consider becoming a $10 a month sustainer, because then you qualify for a one-pound box of truffles from Nicole's Fine Pastry, and that money to support Prairie Public gives you a sweet treat you can send anywhere in the continental United States in time for Valentine's Day. Give a call to 800-359-4145 or go online to prairiepublic.org. For those of you who have, thank you. Friday on our show, Jack Russell Weinstein joins us for a preview of this Sunday's Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life, when he'll visit with Robert Gleave on the subject, What is Sharia Law? We'll have another in a Harvest Public Media series on tariffs. News director Dave Thompson will join us for our weekly news chat, and Madeline will review At Eternity's Gate. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.